Consider this case of multiple identity disorder. In 2003, the state of Indiana put out to bid a contract to upgrade the state's computer systems that process unemployment claims. Guess who won? Tata America International, which is the U.S.-based subsidiary of India's Tata Consultancy Services Limited. Tata's bid of $15.2 million came in $8.1 million lower than that of its closest rivals, the New York-based companies Del Watt Consulting and Accenture Limited. No Indiana firms bid on the contract because it was too big for them to handle. In other words, an Indian consulting firm won the contract to upgrade the unemployment department of the state of Indiana. You couldn't make this up. Tata was planning to send some 65 contract employees to work in the Indiana Government Center alongside 18 state workers. Tata also said it would hire local subcontractors and do some local recruiting, but most workers would come from India to do the computer overhauls, which, once completed, were supposed to speed the processing of unemployment claims as well as save postage and reduce hassles for businesses that pay unemployment taxes. The Indianapolis Star reported on June 25, 2004. You can probably guess how the story ended. Top aides to then-Governor Frank O'Bannon had signed off on the politically sensitive four-year contract before his death on September 13, 2003, the Star reported. But when word of the contract was made public, Republicans made it a campaign issue. It became such a political hot potato that Governor Joe Kernan, a Democrat who had succeeded O'Bannon, ordered the state agency, which helps out-of-work Indiana residents, to cancel the contract, and also to put up some legal barriers and friction to prevent such a thing from happening again. He also ordered that the contract be broken up into smaller bites that Indiana firms could bid for. Good for Indiana firms, but very costly and inefficient for the state. So now I have just one simple question. Who is the exploiter and who is the exploited in this India-Indiana story? In the old world, where value was largely being created vertically, usually within a single company and from the top down, it was very easy to see who was on the top and who was on the bottom, who was exploiting and who was being exploited. But when the world starts to flatten out through multiple forms of collaboration in which individuals and little guys have much more power, who is on the top and who is on the bottom, who is exploiter and who is exploited, gets very complicated. Some of our old political reflexes no longer apply. Were the Indian engineers not being exploited when their government educated them in some of the best technical institutes in the world inside India, but then that same Indian government pursued a socialist economic policy that could not provide those engineers with work in India so that those who could not get out of India had to drive taxis to eat? Are those same engineers now being exploited when they join the biggest consulting company in India, are paid a very comfortable wage in Indian terms, and, thanks to the flat world, can now apply their skills globally? Or are those Indian engineers now exploiting the people of Indiana by offering to revamp their state unemployment system for much less money than an American consulting firm? Or were the people of Indiana exploiting those cheaper Indian engineers? The India versus Indiana dispute highlights the difficulties in drawing lines between the interests of two communities that never before imagined they were connected, much less collaborators. But suddenly they each woke up and discovered that in a flat world where work increasingly becomes a horizontal collaboration, they were not only connected and collaborating, but badly in need of a social contract to govern their relations. The larger point here is this. Whether we are talking about management science or political science, manufacturing or research and development, many, many players and processes are going to have to come to grips with horizontalization. And it is going to take a lot of sorting out. Just as the relationship between different groups of workers will have to be sorted out in a flat world, so too will the relationship between companies and the communities in which they operate. whose values will govern a particular company and whose interests will that company respect and promote. It used to be said that as General Motors goes, so goes America. But today it would be said, as Dell goes, so goes Malaysia, Taiwan, China, Ireland, India. HP today has 142,000 employees in 178 countries. It is not only the largest consumer technology company in the world, it is the largest IT company in Europe, the largest IT company in Russia, the largest IT company in the Middle East, and the largest IT company in South Africa. Is HP an American company if a majority of its employees and customers are outside of America, even though it is headquartered in Palo Alto? Corporations cannot survive today as entities bounded by any single nation state, not even one as big as the United States. So the current keep you awake at night issue for nation states and their citizens is how to deal with corporations that are no longer bounded by a thing called the nation state. To whom are they loyal? On December 7, 2004, IBM announced that it was selling its whole personal computing division to the Chinese computer company Lenovo to create a new worldwide PC company, the globe's third largest, with approximately $12 billion in annual revenue. This new Chinese-owned computer company, headquartered in New York with factories in Raleigh and Beijing, will have a Chinese chairman, an American CEO, an American CPO, and a Chinese CFO, and it will be listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Would you call this an American company? A Chinese company? Even identifying a company's country of origin today is getting harder and harder. Sir John Rose, the chief executive of Rolls-Royce, told me once, "We have a big business in Germany. We are the biggest high-tech employer in the state of Brandenburg. I was recently at a dinner with Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, and he said to me, 'You are a German company. Why don't you come along with me on my next visit to Russia to try to drum up business there for German companies?'" The German Chancellor, said Rose, was recognizing that although my headquarters were in London, my business was involved in creating value in Germany, and that could be constructive in his relationship with Russia. Here you have the quintessential British company, Rolls-Royce, which, though still headquartered in England, now operates through a horizontal global supply chain, and its CEO, a British citizen knighted by the Queen, is being courted by the Chancellor of Germany to help him drum up business in Russia because one link in the Rolls-Royce supply chain happens to run through Brandenburg. Sort that out.